Well, hey, everybody. Yeah. Welcome to the Craft Podcast, where Michael and I interview experts of various fields to learn about their disciplines and how they strive towards mastery. We love talking to people who are passionate enough to master something. And we've been asking curious questions of these craftspeople our whole lives. And it's a joy to share those conversations with all of you on the Craft Podcast. You'll love all the interviews, so please be sure to like and subscribe to the channel. Click the like button and leave a comment if there's anything you want to share. Let's get right into it. Michael, who's with us today?
All right. Today, we are joined by Justin Scarpone, a strategic and operational executive with over 25 years of experience in leadership, production, marketing, and sales in the gaming and mobile industries. So he has worked for major companies like Disney and Scopely and managing their business in Asia and leading successful franchises like Disney Samsung and also Marvel Future Fight. And with his extensive network of regional contacts and fluency in Japanese, Justin excels at business development, negotiations, and also platform planning. Join us as we explore his passion for content and also technology and learn from his impressive track record of creative and also financial success. We're honored to have Justin on the show, and we look forward to diving into his insights and also experiences. Justin, welcome to the Craft Podcast.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you, Dan. I really appreciate it. I'm pretty excited to be able to participate today, and thanks for your kind words. I look forward to getting into it a bit, talking about some games.
Yeah. So to kick things off, Justin, you don't look particularly Japanese, but you've worked in Japan for, a lot of your career. How did you decide to learn Japanese and build a career in Japan?
Well, yeah, you did get me. I'm not originally from Japan. I grew up in the U.S. I actually found my way to Japan sort of by accident. I was part of when I was, I believe, 16 years old, when I was in high school, I was invited to be on a USA wrestling team that toured Japan. I was wrestling all through my schooling years, all the way through university. And so I was asked to come here, and this is in the mid 80s, I think 1986, around that time. And it was very much an eye opener for me to come to such a, what was for me a very foreign place and have no understanding of the culture or the language. This is obviously pre-internet, so it was not as easy to access information on Japan prior to visiting. So we spent the better part of 2 weeks touring the country and competing in various locations, and really changed me. So after the tour ended, I went back to the States, where I went to university, and decided when I entered university that I would try my hand at Japanese, and ultimately majored in East Asian studies. And studied my junior year in Japan. I had a strong desire to live in Japan and see how much of the language I could learn. So my junior year, I studied abroad in Kyoto. And so it just sort of, it's one of those random things that, you know, snowballed over time and became more and more of my passion and the focus of my studies and ultimately my career thereafter.
Wow. That's the first introduction I've heard to Japanese culture via wrestling.
Yes. Yeah, I think it's pretty random. Pretty random.
but a pretty cool starting point. One of the things I've noticed about I guess the bulk of people who, you know, maybe learn another language in college or in high school and go to a different country from where they grew up and stay for a while, they most people tend to go back to their home country, but you decided to kind of build an international career. How did you decide to do that, and what were kind of the challenges that you faced doing so, and how did you overcome them?
Well, it was when I first graduated university, my plan was to come back to Japan and work for a period of time. I think I had set the parameters of 3 to 5 years, and then said, and then I'll go get my MBA and move back to the States. But what I found was after that 5 years had passed, I actually took my GMATs and was scheduled to go to business school. I even had the business school lined up and was planning to move to London, actually, to go to business school. And an opportunity just presented itself to change jobs and join an internet startup in 1996. So I'm dating myself a bit. Dial-up days, fixed line only. It was brutal, but at the time, it was revolutionary. And so, a friend of mine, a Japanese man, started a business right in my neighborhood and invited me to join and get in early. And that proved for me to be the ultimate business school. You learn fast when you have severe cash flow pressure. You learn how to do business development, sales. You learn how to fast track your product development. You learn how to manage teams and motivate teams out of necessity. You learn a lot of things that way. So I ultimately didn't go to business school. I went into the startup instead, and it kept me in Japan. In Asia, I did a couple of years in Singapore, setting us up a subsidiary of our startup in Singapore. But ultimately, that opportunity and migrating my career to the internet kept me in Japan. And at that point, I just decided more to commit to the long haul.
Wow. And that was, I guess, a Japanese company, right?
Yes.
But I guess international operations, and you've also spent a lot of time working for international companies in Japan. So you've had to, through that process, I imagine, build a lot of trust across different cultures. Over time, like, what has been your approach to doing that, building trust between local teams and an overseas headquarters? And also building trust with local teams when, you're not from the country where, most of the people on your team are from.
Right, right. Well, there's a lot of challenges there. When I first started my career, I was in a very large Japanese company. And when I'd go on business trips to other regions, be it North America or Southeast Asia, you would hear gripes about the headquarters and how the headquarters doesn't get it. And then... Right. Fast forward a decade, and I'm an executive in Disney Japan, and we would have our gripes about headquarters and how they don't get things, and that is just an understandable, very human way of seeing sort of the HQ versus subsidiary relationship. And when you're working cross border, it is challenging to build trust even in a common language, because without that face-to-face relationship, it's not easy. And then couple that with time zones and language barriers and obviously significant cultural differences, these are non-trivial things when you're building and leading teams to factor in and to over time build in a skill set for of managing and leading. And I think I can only speak in general terms, which is, I think, what makes a great leader is pretty consistent, and much of regardless of culture, and much of what informs my perception of a good leader was informed during my 17 years in Disney, because I had a lot of exceptional bosses and received a lot of exposure to excellent people across all disciplines. And so my view on leadership is that, you know, in general, the leader works for the team, the leader works for the partners, the leader works for the customers, and not the other way around. And so if you're a leader, I think you're doing yourself a favor if you, regardless of what country you're in, seeing your role is to take care of the people in your organization first and foremost. Your role is to take care of your customers, and your role is to take care of your business partners. Sometimes you need to represent your business partner's interests back to the headquarters, or right, or to your boss, who may have a differing opinion from what you believe and is in the best interests of the partnership. And so being a leader is complicated, but I think there's several sort of key things that you can, at least that I glean from my experience, that are important and have helped me in Japan. One is being very curious about individual team members' needs and business partners' needs. So that means when you're doing one-on-ones or having dinners with your partners, asking a lot of questions and trying to get at what's their motivation and how I can, as a leader, maximize their talents. If I get the most out of them and unlock their ambition and their sort of passion for what they do, it's going to help me. Right. So asking a lot of questions to better understand them, as necessary, coach them, support them, and obviously learn from them. So I try to do that quite a bit, because ultimately it makes me a better leader, and it, you know, pragmatically speaking, increases my probability for success. So I think being curious is really, really important. And the other word that, again, I picked up very much when I was at Disney that is used quite a bit is thoughtfulness. And I think in most Asian cultures, thoughtfulness is taken to a higher level. You know, paying attention is certainly in Japan, it is. And you know, paying attention to detail, and that includes, you know, expressions on a team member's face or their posture in a meeting or an off-the-cuff remark that they make that may have some deeper meaning, right, because things are not always so bluntly or directly stated in this culture as it is in some other cultures. And so being very thoughtful to follow up with people and ask them how things are going, but also following up with them to compliment them when they've done a good job. And let them know that you see what they're doing and that what they're doing matters. And again, ultimately, a motivated workforce is a very powerful thing. And you, as the leader, need to be very good at unlocking that. And again, then you represent their needs into the headquarters cross border. And that too needs to be a constructive relationship. So you do need to get on a plane and go to headquarters and spend time with folks and understand their motivations in headquarters and right, be a balanced representative of the company's needs back into your team. So it cannot be an antagonistic relationship. It has to be like something where you're, you know, seeing both sides and really trying to always work towards a sort of common direction forward that people are comfortable with. And I think when you're talking about like US to Asia, US to Japan, there's always ample risk that things will get misunderstood or not properly communicated. So you really need to work hard, be thoughtful about the details and following up with people. I think that's always my case. It served me well to work that way.
Yeah, a lot of great insights there. I think that the one specific one that you pointed out that maybe isn't as obvious to people, I guess our audience is mostly English speakers who haven't worked in Asian cultures before, particularly East Asian cultures, is the kind of level of indirectness if Americans don't like something, you'll hear about it. pretty directly and often quickly. But a lot of times in East Asian cultures, you know, you mentioned like a kind of an off the cuff remark or something said, you know, in context of a bunch of other things in a meeting might actually have a deeper meaning. And it's not that anyone is trying to be indirect or trying not to express themselves. It's just the way that people express their views to maybe their boss is different than you tend to see in Western cultures.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously what you say is important and how you say it is important, and also where you say it. Right. If you're in a meeting room with eight other people, you have to, and there's a particular team member you want to address in one degree or another, you have to think about what you say in front of those other seven members, how they will view what you say. I had a boss in Disney, a great boss, who, when I first became a GM, he said to me, "You need to realize that now you're always on stage." Mm-hmm. And what he meant by being on stage was that whether you realize it or not, every comment you make is heard and interpreted by people, sometimes in ways you didn't intend, or you didn't realize maybe you're having a bad day and you make a comment that you really didn't mean, or you know, maybe you meant it, but it's not something that you would ordinarily express, but you were tired or you were in a bad mood, or, you know,
right,
you worried about your kids' grades or whatever it was. And you had a moment of weakness and you said something that you should not have. And then you spend the next 6 months trying to unwind that. And so as a leader, you need to be very careful about what you say. And I think particularly in my experience in Asian territories, that's particularly the case, because one of the great strengths, I think, of folks in the US is that they're very direct, very expressive, but when they say something they don't necessarily mean or they regret later on, they're also pretty direct and open about acknowledging that, and so which is a good quality. And I think that at least in Japan, where I have the most experience, I'm comfortable in saying that it's harder to unwind something once you've said it too. So you need to be careful about, you know, making as few mistakes up front as you can. It's not that people won't forgive you, but it's just, it just is a little bit more subtle, I guess, communication, and therefore harder to take things back or minimize their impact after the fact. So you just need to be very thoughtful, again, to use that word, about what you say, how you say it, and where you say it.
Yeah. Thinking about those three together makes a big difference.
Yes.
I guess another thing that kind of came out in your comments is, to some extent, it sounds like it's less about trying to optimize for specific cultures. There are, you know, rules of kind of being a good leader that brings different groups with different interests together. And a lot of the culture stuff, maybe I'm kind of projecting my own views here, so you could share your comments in a minute. But a lot of the cultural stuff is kind of a veneer over top of general human things that are going to be pretty stable to some extent in any environment that's, you know, bringing different people with different interests and backgrounds together.
I mean, I think this is right. I've had the honor of managing people across Asia Pacific, right? People in, you know, everywhere from like Thailand and Singapore and Taipei and Shanghai and Beijing and Seoul and, you know, obviously Tokyo. And so there are significant differences between folks, and it's not just language. Culture is a driving factor of that. But I think underlying to that is what is culturally agnostic is that people want to be treated with respect. They respond when you show a genuine interest and curiosity in what they're doing and who they are. And if you're thoughtful about how you engage with them and you represent their best interests, these tenets are culturally agnostic. Now, I am a pretty vocal in my experiences in Disney and Scopely, I've been pretty vocal throughout my career about, you know, hating the word global, because I think, frankly, the word global is usually used as another way of saying U.S. export. In business. And, you know, there, for example, in the gaming industry, I don't think you could name for me five really truly, maybe not even three truly global game companies. There are no companies that I'm aware of that really addresses the different regions and cultures competitively, consistently. And, there's a reason for that. And the world is a very big place and a very complex place. And I've been fine with that for a very long time. I prefer that and enjoy that. I don't think that all the world's all gravitating to the same thing now. I think that's nonsense. But I think underneath the human sort of key tenets of being treated with respect and knowing that your boss cares about you and is curious about what you're up to and wants to understand you and feels obligated to take care of you. Those things are universal. Yeah.
Yeah. Great points.
Yeah. All right. So I think also like I'll raise a question. So basically, since your extensive experience in, you know, this in APAC and also international kind of business, so like I guess from your prior experience, you have a lot of cases in, like, you know, doing negotiations with different people with different cultural backgrounds. So like what kind of strategy have you found most effective, and also how do you like balance the short-term goals and also with long-term relationships? And maybe that's what I'm curious about, you know.
So yeah, well, that's a huge subject in and of itself, right? Business development. I would not consider myself like pure BD guy. I've done business development on and off for a large part of my career. And I think there obviously when I was in Disney, much of the business development, the deals that I was involved in were either distribution deals or licensing deals. And that requires a real sort of partner mentality, partner focus. And I think it's entirely consistent with my comments earlier about how you lead teams. Mm-hmm. You know, taking, one of the things I really enjoyed about, you know, being in a company like Disney, we have literally, when I was running Disney Consumer Products in Japan, I had 350 licensees, companies. Mm-hmm. Wow. That, you know, every year I would sign contracts, some with them, with some of them multiple contracts per year. Which means I had a great sales and client management team. And they really, went through great pains to understand the different business objectives of the partners and try to sort of proactively propose ways that they could leverage the Disney IP to maximize their business objectives. And we would constantly discuss ways that we could partner in order to maximize the size of the business and super serve the end customers as best we can, which in the case of Disney is really the lifeline of the company. Without the fans, there's no business. Right. Those type of deals, the mentality when you go in and negotiate those deals is one thing. And some of those deals tend to be very long-term relationships with large companies that extend over multiple years, but you nevertheless periodically renegotiate, renew deals, a lot of our game deals would be multi-year deals, but for consumer products, for example, most of our deals were one-year deals with auto renewals, but we had these processes in place for, we had what we used to call JBP, which was actually a Disney Japan developed process, joint business planning. So we had an annual, as if like an annual budget in an internal organization, we had joint business plans with each of our key licensees. And depending on the size of the business with them, if the annual retail revenue generated by those businesses or the royalties that Disney received in those businesses were at a certain level, sometimes the business plans would be quarterly reviews. And depending on the size of the business, you know, the general manager of the division, myself, or my directs would sit into each proposal. Sometimes they were done more at lower levels if they were smaller relationships. So it wasn't just the negotiation of the deal, but the maintenance of the relationship ongoing. In the game world, it's kind of like live ops, if you will. In a licensed business, that's very important. Now, when you talk about some of the deals that, you know, over the past few years, I've been, you know, to one degree or another involved in it at Scopely, is a lot of that has a more of an investment component to it. So that was new for me. And I learned a lot from the guys in Scopely who are very good at that in corporate development and, you know, looking at different types of companies, making different types of investments. And I think the mentality there, when you go into a deal and negotiation, it's, if anything, it's a more rigorous process to get to a deal, because you're talking about making significant capital outputs and potentially acquiring companies, right? And so that means bringing all of these talented folks into your organization and being responsible for them ultimately in their careers. And again, as leaders, ultimately, when you're looking at a potential investment and an acquisition, you're ultimately thinking, how do we incorporate these folks into our organization? Are they a fit? How could we, you know, post investment, post acquisition, maximize the creative and financial output of that, right? The mindset going into negotiations depends on the type of deal. And then in terms of short versus long-term, again, it depends sometimes on the scale of the investment or the size of the partnership. But to try to give you, my specific style, I would say that I'm not the guy you see in movies, the tough guy, zero sum. It's killer.
Bang on the table.
Yeah. None of that nonsense. I don't negotiate that way. But I do think the first step, one thing I would like to mention here is the first step when you go into negotiation. There was a training course that we received back when I was at Disney, and there was a phrase that the man who originated the whole program came up with called BATNA. And BATNA is an acronym, right? And I think some of you may be familiar with it, which is best alternative. A negotiated agreement. So it's kind of like knowing if the deal doesn't happen and you need to walk away, what are your other alternatives? So it's basically, before you go into negotiation, I think one of the key things is knowing what your leverage points are, having done the proper homework in advance, understanding what levers you could pull to get a negotiated agreement that makes sense for you. And what lines you shouldn't cross. And this is often a very much a data exercise, but financially saying, okay, to make this deal make sense for us, here's sort of the parameters within which I need to keep. And then at the same time, when you go into those negotiations, gradually, hopefully, if you're a good negotiator, you're starting to get a better understanding of the partner's parameters, right? Mm-hmm. And because it's, you know, it... a deal is only going to be successful if both partners are successful. Ultimately, I've had deals, by the way, I've done deals where, we were a little more successful than the partner was. And what happens there is those don't become long-term relationships. And so you, you know, if you're looking just to, hey, I'm $5 million short in the current forecast and I need to come up with a quick $5 million, I need to do a quick deal. That's one type of negotiation. But if you're looking to ultimately create growth for multiple fiscal years and something that's going to become meaningful for the company's bottom line, your negotiation approach is very different as well. So I think it really depends, but going in, my style was always been to like understand what my parameters were first, even before the first meeting or the first negotiation, and then spend much of the early negotiations just trying to ask questions and understand where the partner's sort of sweet spot is, what they're, what's going to make this deal exciting for them. And does that match with what we need?
Great.
Do you think that approach worked better or worse depending on who was on the other side of the table? Because what you described is kind of what I was taught when I did an MBA. Like that's the kind of modern proper approach to negotiations. But I also wonder, you know, there are different styles. There are the bang on the table people. I don't know if you know the proper thoughtful style is always the best. Like where does it shine? Where does it fall down? Or any specific examples?
I that's a tough question to answer because I think it has more to do with what type of company your organization aspires to be.
Values.
Yeah. I mean, like I've worked for four companies in my career and 85 to 90% of my thinking is influenced by Disney. And even today. And that's the leader I became was largely driven by my experiences in Disney, and the leader I aspire to be is still driven largely by that. And so Disney has a certain way of doing things. But even within Disney, depending on the division, it could be different. When I first joined Disney, it was a bit different than what it became during the Bob Iger era, which I think was a very healthy place to be and to learn if you were an ambitious person, because values and business results were always hand in hand. And what I learned most of all is you can do both. Being a nice person does not mean you're going to fail. I will name drop one person who no one watching this podcast may know, except Disney folks who will know very well, a gentleman named Ben Pine. And Ben is probably one of the nicest guys you'll ever meet. And Ben, for a long time, was driving a lot of the negotiations for the most valuable properties of the Walt Disney Company, you know, their cable channels, you know, ESPN and the Disney Channel, all that. And he would go in and negotiate multi-billion dollar distribution deals with companies like Comcast and so forth, and created incredible value during his time at Disney for Disney. And Ben was the nicest guy you ever met. And you never heard a bad word about him. Even the people who negotiated with him like him. Mm-hmm. Like most people are not that saintly, but I will also say that Ben was also a brilliant negotiator who really understood his business and understood his levers and his parameters and his BATNA. And he was one of many great mentors I was fortunate to have during my time at Disney. But you can't underestimate the power of guys like that to get things done. So I think in other companies, a different approach works very well. And it really depends more on what your organization aspires to be, partially maybe also which industry you're in. Like I was, you know, Disney Entertainment Company, very aspirational brand. It's a brand everybody knows at the consumer level. There's certain obligations that come with that and reputation and so forth. And so I won't say all companies should do that or can do that, but it's my preference.
Okay. Yeah. That's pretty insightful. And now I'll probably switch the direction here. So from like years of experience in Disney, so looking ahead, So what are the biggest opportunities or challenges like you see maybe facing gaming or mobile industries like for particularly in Asia? And also, like, how do you stay on top of the curve so that you can have always have the big pictures and also vision for the future?
Well, those are two very big questions. I'll start with the second one because I can probably answer it quicker. How do you stay on top is, I would say, surround yourself and hang out with really smart people who can teach you stuff. Read, and not just Twitter, like read stuff. things that people spent more than 5 minutes thinking about before they wrote. And I'm reading a book right now that is helping me think very differently about Web3. And I'm still trying to figure out, like everybody, you know, what Web3 will mean for companies in the next few years. But I'm finding just going very old school and reading a book and spending a few hours thinking about nothing else at a time really helps. But I think in terms of trying to keep up with where the industry is headed, one good thing about getting old, and there's not a lot of good things about getting old, but one of the good things is there is something to this, you know, experience leading to wisdom thing. Like, as you know, the market was about a year and a half, 2 years ago, really making a lot of noise about Web3 and blockchain and crypto. And it just felt like the latest wave of something that has come before, but each wave is different. But you kind of understand the psyche around early stage when these paradigm shifts happen, how that impacts different organizations and what stages in its evolution are required, not just for technology to evolve and regulatory issues to be worked through, but also consumer adoption. And you just, when you get older, you've already seen this. I saw one of these in the 90s, and then I saw one of these in the mid, you know, around the SNS boom, the original phase of that. And so I see this as another wave in sort of the internet's evolution, and taking the time to read, to speak with people who understand it better than you do, to really not be afraid to allow your student, even when you're in your 50s.
I see.
So I would say that in terms of where the Asia is going, I think that was your other question.
So yeah, because I think recently I've been also I used to follow a lot of trends and also trying to catch up, but recently also like I think after my graduation, I started to reading the books written by Ray Dalio on principles and also some of his writings on history. So like he was like so I was trying to say like it's really important to build a system for how do you process information and how to optimize your own human computer to try to have a really aligned system so that can help you to grow and also evolve at the same time. So that's really important. Yeah.
Yeah, Michael, I couldn't agree more. I think you're absolutely right. Like you have to train your own brain, and there's a degree of discipline required because there's just an exorbitant amount of noise anytime a new technology evolves or a new form of gaming or a new, like, a few years ago, everybody was talking about hyper casual, and there were some companies that chased after that. And I'm not knocking hyper casual. I'm just saying that you need to be comfortable, I think, sometimes with taking a step back and trying to see how all this fits together and build that skill into your brain and how you spend your time. That, you know, having a little bit of discipline to say, like, okay, I'm not going to spend any time on social media this afternoon. Instead, I'm going to, you know, read a couple articles on this particular, whatever it is. And go a little bit deeper there. But you know, it's a balance. Yeah. I think there's a lot of value and a lot of knowledge you can glean off of social media. And so I just think it's a bit of a balanced appetite or balanced diet, I should say, of what you're consuming in terms of information. I think your other question was about like game industry trends, particularly in Asia and where it's headed. Is that correct?
Yeah.
So, I think the thing I always like to say up front in things like this is, number one, game is the largest form of entertainment in the planet. And a lot of us in the industry know that, but very few people outside of the industry actually know that. And particularly in the US, where, you know, TV and films are just so core to the DNA of the culture. And, you know, being in a company like Disney, where games is an ancillary business, even to this day, in terms of its contribution to EBITDA, that it's hard for people sometimes to realize that games is significantly larger at this point than any other form of entertainment. And the growth rates on games are higher. So it's actually putting distance between itself and other forms of entertainment. And within that, Asia, obviously the largest region, the dominant region, the most advanced region, the most technically and creatively dynamic industry, the region with the most talent in the industry, for sure. And so we should say that as people based in Asia, unapologetically and proud. And I think that much of the change in the next few years, as has been the last 20, will be driven out of Asia. So again, blockchain gaming, artificial intelligence. Sure, a tremendous amount of innovation will come from other regions, but I think in gaming in particular, Asia will continue to lead. I do think it's important to also point out what you guys know, which is that there is no one Asia. And then even when I'm strategically trying to segment the region for the purposes of budgeting and strategic planning, I would say at this point, I view basically there's four parts to Asia, if you will. There's China, which is just China is standalone. Like, you have to view China uniquely because of both the fact that it's the largest gaming market in the planet, the fact that it has the most talented workforce in the world for gaming, but also the fact that it's a heavily regulated market that's not particularly friendly to foreign companies from a publishing standpoint. It's heavily restricted. A lot of the innovation that we've seen in the last few years, in particular in free-to-play, has come out of China. And there's just a massive amount of talent, and that's not changing. So China comes with a lot of questions if you're not a Chinese company about how to do business effectively there. But you cannot deny the importance of China as a consumer market, and certainly as a producer and exporter of content. The second bucket, I would say, is advanced, or let's say mature markets in Asia, which I put Japan at the top of the list, and Korea a close second, just because it's smaller than Japan. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I like to point this out, you know, if you just talk about mobile gaming, Japan and Korea combined is on an absolute basis bigger than the United States, despite the fact that the populations, even when you combine them, is still only half the population of the US. Right. That's how big gaming is ingrained in the culture in these two countries. And a tremendous amount of innovation still comes out of Korea, the birthplace of free-to-play gaming, arguably. Japan, the leader, you know, the first major Asian country to get into gaming in a meaningful way, and still incredibly important, the number three gaming market in the world, home of Sony and Nintendo, and excluding the US, probably the single biggest generator of high value IP in the world for gaming. Japan and Korea, and also, you know, high yield consumer markets, very sophisticated consumers who spend a lot in gaming and are experts in gaming, like in China. So I would say China, the mature markets, then the emerging markets would be the third bucket, Southeast Asia in particular. And what's interesting about Southeast Asia is, among other things, it's a very young population, and they're really leading the way in the newer forms of gaming, such as esports, blockchain gaming. I think in the next few years, Southeast Asia will become a region that globally aspiring companies will pay more attention to. But, you know, there's a lot of challenges still in distributing games in Southeast Asia because of payment, obviously different language, different cultures, different regulatory environments and so forth. But the innovation blockchain gaming has really, you know, been driven a large part out of that part of the world. So, and then the fourth bucket is India, which, like China, for very obvious reasons, you should look at it as its own region. As a consumer market, not as interesting yet as the other three, because it's not as big yet. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, it may be the region, well, along with Japan, that has the most local content and over time, a healthy sort of local studio ecosystem. I think today, Indian studios are just starting to show potential to be globally competitive. I don't think they're there yet. But there's a lot of positive growth happening in India, not just at the consumer level, but at the developer level. So it's one to watch.
Great.
Yeah, for sure. That's a broad review, but I think a good summary of the diversity across APAC. And there are other markets that, you know, those buckets don't even mention, like Taiwan is the fifth or sixth largest game market in the world. And it's
absolutely
really unique. So
I would definitely say, like, I sort of tend to group Hong Kong, Taiwan, Australia, New Zealand, along with like Japan, Korea, as like the mature gaming markets. You're talking about sophisticated. Because it's small, I didn't mention Taiwan, but it certainly is one of the mature markets. Obviously, small population, but highly sophisticated, high ARPU gaming market. I don't lump it in with emerging markets at all. Actually, I think Taiwan is far more advanced than that.
For sure. Yeah. Well, then the first bucket has to be called mainland China, so we don't get canceled.
Yes. Well, and there's just the fundamental difference in distribution that, you know, the very fact that there's no Google Play versus Google Play being very healthy in Taiwan and Hong Kong, that alone is a huge
difference.
Yeah, definitely.
And
the consumer preferences
are really different.
So from mainland to Taiwan, for example. I just think that they certainly, Taiwan for sure and Hong Kong for sure, within the mature markets bucket in my mind.
Right.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about some of the IPs, because I think some of the game IPs in particular that you worked with most closely are actually really unique to Asia. I'm thinking of like Kingdom Hearts and Tum Tum, I guess even more particularly to Japan itself. And probably when you first started interacting with those IPs or potential IPs, if you had pitched those to me 10 years ago, I would have thought that doesn't make any sense. Like why is Goofy in an RPG game battling monsters?
Right.
And, you know, why is Disney making digital Beanie Babies? But those have been incredible successes, both financially, but also in terms of creatively. You know, Kingdom Hearts is a beloved IP. So yeah, if you know, you can share any of the stories behind how those came about, but also, you know, how do you find opportunities like that when there's probably a sea of options?
One of the many pleasures I had of being my position at Disney was that, you know, we were given a great deal of empowerment from the headquarters to, you know, understanding that Asia, gaming in Asia is at another level in terms of the scale and also the creative talent across the different territories. So Disney was smart enough to know that there's great developers in Japan, in China, in Korea that could help interpret our IP, which is already very strong in all those countries, of course, thanks to the films and theme parks and consumer products and television, and now Disney Plus. And, you know, but, you know, how local talent, local creative talent, local technical talent could help interpret our IP and put it into that form of entertainment, gaming. And, you know, I really respect that our leadership in LA knew enough to know that that was something that would elevate the brand in certain cases. And, you know, we always needed to have a rigorous creative process to get to a decision whether to do a game or not, just like we have the same process in the West. But being open to the idea that the characters could expand in what they do and who they are in these worlds, that it's not just derivative content, but in some sense it evolves the stories. And sometimes we create new characters, like in the case of Kingdom Hearts. First and foremost, something like Kingdom Hearts, it's important to say up front that Kingdom Hearts is not Kingdom Hearts without Square Enix. I mean, Square Enix is a fabulous creative organization and a technical or innovative organization. And the partnership, to sort of harken back to our conversation a little bit earlier, it's like that was built the relationship with Square Enix and Disney has evolved over 20 years now. And it literally started 3-4 years before I even joined Disney. So I can't take credit for starting Kingdom Hearts. I did not. The two people who started Kingdom Hearts, one in Square Enix, one in Disney, it just so happened that they shared an elevator ride and they were in the same office building, Disney and Square. This was before Square Enix, when it was still Square. They were in the same elevator and they just struck up a conversation, and it led to some brainstorming, some more detailed conversations, going to LA and Burbank to make the pitch. It was not always well received internally in Disney. It took a while to get people to understand why the game division felt working with Square at the time and Square Enix thereafter on, you know, the makers of Final Fantasy, why Disney partnering with them and mashing up characters and creating new characters in this world, how we could make it from a brand perspective make sense and make a compelling game. Right. But the is in the creative output, and the creative output over multiple games and platforms over the years. A lot of talented people have contributed to it. And I had the honor of, on the Disney side, of managing the franchise for a decade. So, and I came in, there was a big lull in the franchise. It was 5 years since Kingdom Hearts 2 had come out. And it was really not, it was a couple of smaller, like handheld titles, but there was no roadmap for the future. And I thought that odd. And as I got my head around the business and got to know, the CEO at Square Enix at the time, Wada-san, and then the current CEO, Matsuda-san, after that, we were able to negotiate multiple new deals. Kingdom Hearts, taking the back catalog and up-resing them for PlayStation 4 and Xbox, launching a mobile title, and all tie into and leading to Kingdom Hearts 3, which was shipped in 2019. So, it was a highlight of my career to be involved in that franchise and to get to be in the room with a lot of the creative sessions between Square Enix and their director, Nomura Tetsuya, in LA and up at Pixar with the brand owners of Frozen and Big Hero and Toy Story and Monsters, Inc. And sitting in the room in those offices in California while they were working on script and scenarios and just getting people coffee and staying out of the way of the career. I try not to hurt myself. That's a career highlight for me. And then Tsum Tsum, and a lot of folks don't know Tsum Tsum outside of Japan, but it's actually the biggest, most successful game on any platform in the history of the Walt Disney Company in terms of financial performance. And it's a massive, massive hit. It's been in the market now 9 years, still consistently in top 10 grossing in Japan. The largest, the most downloaded game app in the history of the App Store in Japan to this day. The largest DAU of any game in Japan, even today, after 9 years.
Wild.
Massive hit. And that came out of a conversation. That one, I was there on day one because it was a phone call between me and the head of the Disney Store Japan. And we came up, he was working on this plush and he showed me and I thought it would make a good game. And then I have some really talented team members in Disney Japan who really worked with our partners at Line to come up with the conceit and to prototype, and selling that into Burbank was actually less challenging than Kingdom Hearts because we were all already committed to the consumer product line, the plushes. Mm-hmm. And so coming up with a game seemed additive strategically, but ultimately the game proved to be the real driver of the franchise. And
right.
So much so that eventually we rolled out consumer products, I think, across like 20 or 30 different licensees in Japan. And they started selling the merchandise globally in all the parks, including in Shanghai and Hong Kong and Florida and LA and Paris. And they created animation shorts for the Disney Channel based on it. And that all came out of like a phone call in Meguro, Tokyo, in 2013, I think. And you're talking about a multi-billion dollar franchise created out of Japan. So a company like Disney being able to do that, it was a great honor to be allowed to be part of that. Even now, in my neighborhood, people sort of tease me about that game because everybody plays that game and know I was associated with it for a long time. So they like to come and my kids' friends all call me Tsum Tsum Papa.
That's a great nickname.
Maybe Justin's too hard a name for them to remember, but Tsum Tsum they can remember.
Right. Okay. Maybe we'll change the title of this video to interview with Tsum Tsum Papa.
Yeah. I mean, it shows the power of a good idea because so many people contributed to it. The partners are employees, not just in the core team in Tokyo, but then folks in the U.S., folks around the region. And then, you know, I left Disney about 4 years ago and, you know, Kingdom Hearts 4, they're working on right now. And Tsum Tsum is still a top, you know, when you create great IP, it's more important than any exec, any individual. And it just continues to be popular, even when you change creatively, sometimes if it's done in the right way. And so successful franchises, IPs are just invaluable. And in gaming industry, it's the same thing.
Yeah. Well, then going back to, I guess, the last part of the question, you probably saw lots of ideas like those come through as potentials. You know, how do you decide which ones to invest in versus not? And I guess any cases where it didn't, you know, where it wasn't the big success, and how do you learn from those?
Yeah, so there were cases where we failed and we don't talk about those. you know, one of the things that I think is a prerequisite to having a successful new IP or a new game or something is, like, in a case of Tsum Tsum, we knew we wanted to create a game with Line because we had already, you know, the messaging app Line, which is the default, it's the WeChat of Japan, right? And I had spent time with their CEO, understood their business strategy, again, to call back to earlier conversation.
Right.
We'd already been in business together because Disney helped Line launch their stamp business, which is a very lucrative business here, selling all types of emoji and stamps online in Japan. I know in other Asian property and like WeChat and Kakao doesn't monetize well, but in Japan, even today, it monetizes very well. Wow. So we already had a business relationship with LINE and Disney, but we knew that we wanted to do something bigger in the game space. And we just had that that moment where I saw these plushes that the Disney Store Japan had originally developed, and it was based on these sort of a Buddhist principle, you know, something you see at Buddhist temples of stacking stones. But instead of stones, you had the idea of cute Disney plushes. And I said, well, that's a good idea for a casual game. And we wanted to create a casual game because we thought the LINE audience would be very mass audience, not just gamers. So it had to be a very simple gameplay. And we knew we had great style guides from the Disney Store, and we could build upon that in 2D art for gaming. And we just took it from there. With Kingdom Hearts, I mean, it was pretty obvious. The makers of Final Fantasy were also Disney lovers and aficionados, and they had a story for a very compelling story that they pitched to Disney and of how we can make it all work. So it's very case by case. I'll give you one more example. In Japan for years, the idle game genre is very popular, very steady. You know, idle games for predominantly male audiences, idle games for predominantly female audiences. And there was a time I challenged my team in Tokyo. We had already had Kingdom Hearts and SimSim, and I said, okay, I want to go into the idle genre. I think it's Disney can absolutely create original IP in the idle genre. Go out, talk to some partners, come up with your own ideas, and let's do a pitch process. And we did it. And eventually the idea that we arrived at became a game called Disney Twisted Wonderland. Mm-hmm. And Disney Twisted Wonderland is an idle game in Japan. A Disney branded all original characters, but based on and with very strong callbacks to a lot of the traditional Disney stories. And takes place in a university in this sort of alternative universe. And that game is between, you know, top 10, top 20 grossing game in Japan for 3 years now. And the story was written by a Japanese manga artist who had already had some hits, ironically doing some work with Square Enix, not related to Kingdom Hearts. And she was also conveniently a huge Disney fan and aficionado. And so they worked on this whole conceit of what became called Night Raven College, which is where the story takes place. And this game to this day is a top popular game in Japan. The publisher is Aniplex, who is great, you know, the same guys who do Fate Grand Order. So we knew we were working with a company that knew what they were doing. And you know, that was an example of the team internally in Disney Japan figuring out how to work with a potentially great partner and a great writer, a creative mind externally, bringing them in, mashing it up with some of the internal ideas and evolving it into a $15, $20 million a month game. And, you know, that persistently does well. So inevitably we make mistakes by trying to repeat what we did before. And you get diminishing returns, right? So you always kind of feel, oh, this one feels special. This one feels a little different when you're doing something that you're uncomfortable, like that's new. Mm-hmm. Like, and with Twisted Wonderland, which launched after I left Disney, it was in development while I was in Disney. We did the deal while I was there, but I left in sort of mid-development. And when it launched, by the time it launched, I was excited just to see where it landed creatively. And then obviously I knew it was going to be popular because of the passion behind it and the talent behind it. And to the credit of the team and the partner, I mean, it exceeded my expectations.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So it sounds like with each of these three examples in particular, at least it wasn't like there was just a kind of a pitch out of nowhere with a great idea. There were kind of things that stacked up on top of each other. Like, you know, there was this relationship with LINE, that you wanted to build a casual game. There were already the Tum Tum plushies in the stores. You know, you saw kind of the kind of a cultural connection with the stacking things at temples. And that is what brought it together. It wasn't just an idea, like a perfect idea out of the ether. It's like you're connecting things that already kind of sprouting. Yeah.
And in case of gaming, knowing that they're in genres that consumers like and are comfortable with, like RPG, Twisted Wonderland, the idle genre, you know, SimSim, again, a variant of a match three type of puzzle game, things, you know, big genres with big audiences. Another example was in Korea with Net Marvel. We did Marvel Future Fight. It was the same kind of, in you know, sort of that sort of a genre action RPG that it was, they were very good already. Net Marvel, they had proven expertise in the genre, huge passion for the Marvel brand. And the studio that developed the game, the Net Marvel studio called Monster Studio, their GM, Ken Kim, is just a creative. He's a rock star. And so that Ken was pitching us the ideas. It was just, yeah, I want to make some of this guy. And he became so trusted, not only by my team, but Marvel in the US, that they allowed Ken and his team to create several original characters in Marvel Future Fight. That wow. then original Marvel characters that, you know, made in Korea that eventually became even incorporated into some of the US comics.
Wow.
So that they're actually part of the global Marvel character database now and are used from time to time in some of the non-gaming areas of the business. That's when, you know, you have great creative people on the other side of the table, you're in pretty good shape. It's not always, doesn't always work out that way. And sometimes you want something a little too much and you force it.
Right.
But when things go well, there's usually a really great creative person behind it.
Yeah. And that example actually makes me think of something else. You know, there's this term, reverse innovation, which is, I think, pretty Eurocentric and kind of racist too. You know, it encapsulates this idea that there could be a trend of, oh, well, you know, there's things happening in emerging markets that can be applied to other developed markets. You know, typically the term is used when talking about, like, oh, you know, Alibaba supply chains, like, what can the US learn about them? But the games, I think a lot of the games are so unique that you've had that you've been able to work with, like SimSim and Twisted University. It's like there's probably a rich vein of potential to figuring out, well, how could these types of dynamics, either, you know, characters or art styles or stories, gameplay mechanics, that can be applied in other parts of the world.
I've had that question posed to me a lot. Like in Disney, they would say, like, why do you think this game doesn't work as well in the West? Or why does this Western game not work as well in Asia or something like that? And sometimes it just is what it is. Like you, it's not through a lack of effort or innovation necessarily, but, you know, consumer preferences do vary, you know, you know, that's why, you have to be somewhat cognizant of that when you're making games. And you know, this is a business. So when you're thinking about where to place your bets and where to make your investments, you have to obviously have a degree of confidence that you're going to reach a big enough audience with what you're creating and that it's going to be relevant to a big enough audience that you'll get that return on investment.
Right.
But what I would reiterate is that at the end of the day, the Asian markets are the largest ones in gaming today, and putting more and more distance between themselves and other regions. So, you know, if you're in a Western company, the problem is I think you have a little bit of an unconscious bias that you assume if you're in the US, you're in the biggest market. And you know, in the case of films, that's true. Case of television, that's true. In the case of theme parks, that's true. But in the case of games, that's just not factually correct. Mm. So, you know, there the thing that was impressive about Disney, and one of, you know, or many of the bosses I had that were really impressive, one of them was a guy named Jimmy Pitaro. And Jimmy now runs, he's the chairman of ESPN, but at the time he was the head of consumer products and interactive media. And Jimmy understood that, like, Tsum Tsum, you know, is the biggest game in the Walt Disney Company's history. 95% of the revenue lifetime that will make is made in Japan. 95%, and is the biggest game in the country, to the company's history, because the markets, the industry is that big. And but there's that many games that, you know, you, it's not like, compared to films, there's infinitely more games out there that are live services in operations today, right, that are generating meaningful revenue for years. And so your competition is such that you can't necessarily insist that we're going to make one game, it's going to be a big hit everywhere in the world, and we'll get economies of scale. And it sounds really good for MBAs and all that, like, but that's not what the consumers want. Right. And so there are games that have scaled across region. There are examples of that. And so the problem is that the exceptions become what people point to, when the overwhelming majority of games today, up until this point, and I believe into the future, will monetize in certain regions better than others. And that there's nothing wrong with it. If you look at what Garena have done with Free Fire, it's brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant how they decided we're going to focus on emerging markets and super serve the end customers, because we understand the circumstances that they have when they're experiencing our game. Network limitations, handset limitations, payment needs, how they access content, you know, how they are willing to pay for things, micropayments, stuff of that nature. They just do it. And you know, being on the calendars, the social calendars,
right,
the public calendars, those regions, launching events consistent with those parts of the world and prioritizing that. They just went in and found a huge and growing a part of the gaming industry that's largely uncontested right now. And they just went in and in the first person shooter genre, went in and just took it over and own it and do it better than anybody. And I really respect that focus. And, you know, there's other companies that have scaled really well globally with a few titles, but I think most companies tend to be strong in one region or another.
Right. Yeah.
But the pie is so big, I don't necessarily think there's, you know, oh, unless we're strong in all markets, there's an issue. I really, the more I'm in this business, the more I question that. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, as Tsum Tsum proves, like, Japan alone can be enough.
look at, you know, as proud as I'm at Tsum Tsum, look at Honor of Kings.
Mm-hmm. Right. Or China alone.
Yeah. Right. That thing, like, Honor of Kings is not a big game in the Western world, like, right?
No.
Right?
Yeah. Or, but it doesn't need to be.
It doesn't need to be. Look at how big the Lineage franchise is in Asia, right? Mm-hmm. Massive, right? It's not that way in the West, but, you know, over multiple titles now, over multiple decades, Lineage is just a massive franchise. And so I think you have to look at it in that context. There's, in Japan, we have a lot of the top grossing games in mobile or games that don't export at all, like Monster Strike or Fate Grand Order or Puzzles and Dragons. And Disney, you know, Puzzles and Dragons is 10 years old and still monetizes incredibly well.
Yeah.
I see their TV commercials all the time. Yeah. They're top 10 grossing game. It is over 10 years old. Yeah. So, you know, but that game is not making money anywhere else. And still, it's a very healthy business for Gung Ho, who is the company that runs that game. So, you know, I think you have to, if you're a game publisher or a game developer, being particularly strong in one region or another is not necessarily a bad thing.
Right. Yeah. Those are some incredible examples. Justin, as we start to wrap up, is there anything that we didn't cover for the audience that you think we should?
Well, no, it's been a lot of fun. And what I would say is, for those people who are watching that are in the gaming industry, you know, be very proud, be very excited. Change is a given, and there's a lot of change right now, be it, you know, sort of the increased sort of acceleration towards multi-platform and, you know, the somewhat inevitability of Web3 and you know, as business models continue to become diversified, there's, you know, always questions, always things to give you stress, things to figure out. But me personally, I find it very exciting. And the one thing that never changes is that we're in the entertainment business. To me, games are entertainment. You know, when you talk about the game industry, you know, you can talk about everything from the venture capitalists to the streamers, to the influencers, to the live ops, publishers, Apple, Google, all of these important components of the ecosystem. But at the end of the day, none of it matters if it's not serving the customer. The customer is why everything else exists. So whether it's blockchain or if it's multi-platform or if it's traditional free-to-play or if it's console, whatever the genre or the platform, you know, the IP, all of those things are really important, and figuring all that out is the difference between being successful and not. But all the things you're doing, you're doing it for the customer. So
Right. The
one old man sage, pseudo sage word of advice I'd say is never lose sight of the customer, because technology is going to change. It's going to be Web 4.0 at some point. They're going to figure this out.
Right.
You know, AI is going to dramatically impact what we do. And you guys had a great podcast recently on that. And, you know, generative AI is another area that anybody in gaming needs to be paying attention to. But ultimately, all of this, the cool tools and the technologies, again, are all about improving, ultimately, the quality of the output to the consumer.
Right.
And if you keep that as your North Star, you'll probably have enough successes that you can stay in the industry and hopefully make some money.
Yeah. Well, that is an inspiring note to end on. Michael, did you have something to add?
No, I think that's great.
Yeah. Justin, so how should folks follow you, learn more about you're up to, what you're up to?
Well, you know, I have, I'm a little old school. I'm not a big Twitter guy, but I tend to weigh in on what I'm thinking on LinkedIn more and more these days, because obviously a lot of, you know, it's a bit more of a focused adult conversation around gaming and other technology topics. So I tend to do most of my communication on LinkedIn. Anybody who sees this and wants to reach out to me on LinkedIn, happy to have a chat. Increasingly I'm sort of putting my thoughts on LinkedIn as well about where the industry is headed, but I'm as interested to meet other folks too. So anybody who wants to reach out, please do so. Like I said, we're always trying to learn new things here. So at least I am. Yeah, I would say LinkedIn for sure. And I like personal conversations. So just reach out to me and we can link up there.
Yeah, that sounds great. And I'd love to see to hear more of your thoughts on Asia and gaming and entertainment on LinkedIn. So if you're thinking of posting more there, double thumbs up to do it.
Thanks. I think I'd love to do that, because you get great feedback from folks as well. But I really enjoy this. I appreciate your time. And yeah, I'll be a viewer of your future podcast for sure.
Awesome. Thank you. Yeah. Well, don't forget to click like and subscribe when you watch the video, Justin.
Absolutely.
So our guest today has been Justin Scarpone. Justin, thanks so much for being part of The Craft. And thank you, viewers, for listening to or watching The Craft podcast. For more links and information about this episode or to listen to more episodes, you can search for The Craft podcast by Daniel Tedesco and Michael Du on YouTube or anywhere you get your podcasts. Again, please make sure to like and subscribe, leave a review right now, and we'll see you next time. Until then, keep crafting.